Welcome to this week's edition of the Bibliopod, Maclean's Books Podcast. I'm Anne Kingston.
Elizabeth Gilbert was a novelist and successful magazine writer before she catapulted into the zeitgeist with her best-selling 2006 memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. Her latest book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, is a smart and inspiring creativity self-help manifesto, one that dismantles a lot of myths about the creative process. Elizabeth Gilbert joins us today from North Beach, Miami. Thank you for joining us on the Bibliopod.
My very great pleasure. What a nice introduction. Thank you.
You are welcome. So what prompted you to take on the role of creativity cheerleader and coach?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's a subject that I have been pondering and relating to for quite literally my entire life. I decided from a young age that I wanted to be a writer, and somewhere in my adolescence, I looked at all the models of what were available for ways to be artists, and I decided to reject the very romantic, appealing, but ultimately deadly icon of the tormented artist, and instead try to find a way to be like a generative, contented, productive, happy artist. And so I've spent a lot of time kind of looking for paradigms on how to do that. And then in 2009, I gave a speech about creativity at the TED conference that I didn't think anyone would respond to because it was very personal, and it was also basically about like genies and fairies and magic. And the TED conference is full of like tech guys and venture capitalists in the audience, and I was like, this is gonna bomb. But it went really well, and people responded to it all over the world, and it seems like ever since that speech, it's like I hung a sign on my chest that said, please come to me with your questions about creativity, because people started coming. And it was out of all those conversations I've had over the past few years with people that this book was born.
We live in a time of Etsy, of YouTube, everybody being able to describe themselves as a writer, a musician, or photographer. Clearly, you feel that there's a need for this book.
Yeah, you know, we'll see if there's need. I'm always hesitant when people say, you know, I wrote a book because I saw that it was because the world needed me to, you know. and somebody did say to me the other day, well, God, there's so many books out there about creativity. Does the world really need another one? I know only that I needed to write this, and I feel like that's always the very best motive. I needed to write this because I walk around after these conversations I have with people just stirring with ideas and wishing that I could kind of bust them out of their paralysis. I meet a lot of people who are doing and making amazing things, but 10 to 1, I much more often meet people who wish to be doing and making amazing things, who have ideas, but who are blocked by all sorts of obstacles and all sorts of reasons that they can't do their creative work. And as soon as you start scratching at those reasons, no matter how rational they sound, at the bottom of it is always fear. And mostly it's the fear that they don't have permission to do this, that they're not entitled, that they don't live in the right city, that they're not the right age, that they don't have the right degree, they don't have the right materials.
Well, one of the things that you write about in the book is this idea, one you don't have any time for, which is perfectionism. The idea that you call it just a high-end haute couture version of fear.
And it's also worse than that. I mean, I think we all know that perfectionism can be a reason people don't finish things. The more insidious disaster associated with perfectionism is that it's a reason to not start things, to not even begin, because before you've even begun the thing that inspiration is asking you to do, there's a part of you that's already shut it down because you already know it's just not going to be good enough. Somebody else already did it better. The time has passed. Nobody's interested in vampires anymore. Perfectionism is a terrible myth and a lie and a trap because perfectionism assumes that there is such a thing as perfect. And there isn't, because the idea of perfection is so very subjective. And you can show me any work of art in the world that you hold up as something perfect, and I will find you on 2 seconds on the internet, I'll find you people who hate it. people who think that Beethoven is just like bombast and that, you know, the Sistine Chapel looks like cartoons. So this idea that somehow you're going to be able to create something that has no flaws assumes that such a thing can even occur in this world. And in the world of opinion and subjective thought, it simply cannot, you know?
Let's talk about the nucleus of creativity, which is the idea. And you have some very interesting ideas about ideas. One is that they're molecules floating around the universe waiting for someone to seize upon them, that they're disembodied energetic life form with consciousness and will. And they're separate from us, but capable of interacting.
When you say it like that, I sound like an insane person, but let's go with it. You know, empirically, in my lived experience, that's what it feels like. And when you listen to a lot of other creative people talk about what it feels like for them to interact with creative ideas, that seems to be pretty much a universal experience across culture and across ages. And even very rational scientific people, when they talk about having an idea, will use this language of, you know, they'll say an idea came to me. You know, all of a sudden it came to me. All of a sudden the answer came to me. There is this kind of eureka moment. And if it has universal symbols and symptoms. You feel like a little nervous in your stomach. You've got butterflies. You get chills. You get obsessed with thinking about it. All of a sudden it feels like all the coincidences are pointing in the same direction that you should be doing something with this. You know, now, almost certainly there is some very logical neurological reason why all human beings share the same symptoms of inspiration. I'm not really interested in neurology of it. I much better like the mythology of it. And I would much prefer to kind of participate in it the way humans have participated in it forever.
Well, in the book, you support the molecular theory of ideas with a personal story, which is quite fantastic, which is about an idea you'd had been working on for a novel about the Amazonian rainforest involving a middle-aged woman, and it being transmitted to the writer, Ann Patchett. Could you share that story? Because it's really quite amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible story, and I'll try not to take too long in saying it. You've done a pretty good job summarizing it, but I did at one point have a very fleshed out idea. I actually had a book proposal about it, and I had worked on it for many months, an idea about this middle-aged woman from Minnesota who in the 1960s is passionately in love with her married boss working in a boring job in the Midwest. And then his boss gets involved in some sort of a shady and secret deal down in the Amazon jungle, and a person and a bunch of money goes missing, and he sends her down to investigate, at which point her orderly life is overturned and she falls into a world of chaos, and it's really her hero's journey. I had to put the book aside because of personal issues in my own life, and ended up writing a different book instead that year about marriage called Committed. And then when I came back to it, I found that the life force and that idea was gone for some reason. And just around the same time, I made friends with the novelist Ann Patchett. We met at an event and had a very like electric and sparky meeting with each other that actually included a spontaneous kiss where Ann said, I said to her, I love your work. And she said, and I love you. And she gave me this big kiss, and we've been friends ever since. And a couple months later in a letter, she revealed to me that she was working on a novel about the Amazon. And of course, it turned out to be about a spinster from Minnesota who's been in love with her married boss for forever. And he gets involved in a shady project down in the jungle, and a bunch of money, and a person goes missing, and she's sent down there to find it, and it's her hero's journey. I mean, really outrageously exactly the same story. And we like to think that it was exchanged in the kiss. that my novel knew that I was never going to do it because I was distracted by other things, and it really wanted to be born. And so it jumped to the closest novelist it could find who was actually available. You know, history is filled with these kind of weird stories of simultaneous discovery and people coming upon ideas at the same time, or the same thing being written in different parts of the world. It's you know, to me, it just speaks to what the great physicist Edmonton said was his definition of the universe. Something unknown is doing. We don't know what. You know, I feel like we really only know about 1% of what's actually going on here. And I love being allowed to engage with mysterious forces that I cannot name or see or understand, but that I feel. And that to me is sort of the great leap of faith of creativity, because it's a very irrational thing to do. To take nothing and make something that the world is not asking you to do. You know, all art is just, you know, stuff that no one asked for, that people just felt the need to make.
That takes us in a way to Eat, Pray, Love. You write about being shocked when your memoir hit this phenomenal nerve and went on to sell more than 12 million copies and then was made into a movie. But you didn't write as much about the idea behind the book. And it's part of the book's legend and lore that you were able to finance your travel with 100,000 publishers $1 of publisher's advance after pitching the concept. I'm curious to know how much of the architecture of that idea you had mapped out before you began and how that creative process worked along the way.
Well, you know, the real genesis for that idea was that I had been in Indonesia 2 years out earlier on assignment for a magazine, and I had met this medicine man. I mean, it's just very sort of old school mystical encounter. I met this medicine man who weirdly knew things about me he shouldn't have known, and who, you know, looked to my palm and looked like Yoda and seemed to have some kind of deep, authentic spiritual authority, and who said to me, "You are going to come back here. And it's your destiny to come back here. You're going to teach me English, and you're going to live here, and it's going to change your life." And I was at a period in my life going through a divorce. Everything had fallen apart. You know, I feel as though in the great scavenger hunt of our lives, when you get a clue, no matter how ridiculous, sometimes the more ridiculous, the better. But when you get some sort of thing that actually just feels like a clue on the scavenger hunt, you're duty bound to follow it, especially if you have no other ideas about where to go. And so I spent 2 years trying to think, how am I going to get back to Indonesia? And around the same time, I also, you know, had this weird impulse to start to study Italian, because I felt like my head was full of just negativity and bad thoughts. And I thought, if I can replace bad old memories with things that are in a new language that don't have any bad associations with them, maybe I can become happier. So I thought that by learning a second language, I could shift some garbage out of the garage of my brain and fill it with new things. At the same time, I started a meditation practice and started thinking, I'm going to go to India and learn more about this. All of those things seemed contradictory to each other, until the day that suddenly I thought, well, what if you went to all three of those places for all three of these different reasons? Why not? You have nothing else to do.
One of the reasons I think the book resonated was obviously the voice and the sense of authenticity that the book conveyed. And in Big Magic, you write that authenticity is better than originality, in that in the end, there's nothing really truly original out there. But I wanted to ask you about that, because isn't art by its very definition original? For instance, Eat, Pray, Love succeeded because it was the first of what would be a very much imitated genre, with, you know, people, women particularly, going on journeys. I think of Cheryl Strayed's Wild in that regard. But authenticity, on the other hand, doesn't necessarily lead to art. You know, Donald Trump is authentic, for instance. So I'm just curious.
It's a work of art.
Okay, touche.
You know, I mean, look, originality is very difficult. And I love, I mean, thank you and bless you for calling Eat, Pray, Love original, but I would contest that it's not original at all. I think it's one of the oldest stories ever been told, is for somebody to go on a journey looking for a spiritual master.
Absolutely.
After having, you know, now the way I went about it was possibly original, maybe only because we're at a moment in history where women can participate in that story. There's almost even like a section of the bookstore about, you know, it's a travelogue, it's a divorce memoir, it's a spiritual journey. All of those things are things that people have done a million times, and easily I could have said, who wants to read another travel story? Who wants to read another divorce memoir? There's nothing original about this. But what I always tell people when they stop themselves from doing a project, because they say, quite rightly often, they say, it's already been done. You know, my line is, well, it hasn't been done by you. And merely by you doing it and bringing to it your particular human experience that nobody else has had, it will be a new thing. And so don't take yourself out of the game just because you think it's already been done. And I think we can all agree, too, that art that goes out of its way to be original, often, I find it very off-putting.
And often it is an art.
Sometimes I feel like I can admire it. I admire the originality. I think that's pretty cool how you did that. This doesn't change my life anyway. because I don't feel a humanity behind this. All I feel is an anxiety. And the anxiety that you're expressing in this art is that you're so afraid that you're not original, that you've had to bend over backwards to create something, you know, that no one's ever done before, which in and of itself, probably 10 art historians could point to and say, well, it reminds me of these 8 things that other people have already done. So if you're in the battle to be original, I think you're really at war in a way. And I think the more interesting journey is, like, what does your curiosity authentically want to make? And do you trust that? And can you obey that curiosity? and believes that simply by making it, you're creating something that wasn't there before.
I want to conclude with the idea of hard work. Big Magic is very inspiring and incredibly accessible. But at the same time, when you think about magic, it also involves a lot of elbow grease to create the illusion.
Of course.
And you write that you work like a farmer and that even in your 20s, you mentioned the community you created at that time, when you're not, you know, that you worked every day on your writing, even when you weren't making the most responsible decisions elsewhere in your life, you made the point of developing that artistic muscle. And that even days that you're not inspired, that the, you know, muse does not come visiting, you still sit at your desk and work through it.
Somebody said to me the other day, wait, I don't understand. Do you believe in magic or do you believe in hard work? And I was like, yes. The answer is yes. I believe in both of those things. Look at Hermione Granger. She was like, that's who I model my magic on. She like had magical powers and she was a grind. She was in the library every single day, you know, perfecting them. You know, there's a combination of both of those things that need to be cultivated.
I have to ask one last question. Where are your ideas taking you right now? Any particular place?
Thank you. I'm working on a novel about New York City in the 1940s and about showgirls. And it's a bit of a romp, but it also, I'm very interested in female promiscuity and the ways that I feel it hasn't been written about in books. And so I'm interested in writing about girls who are sort of on the wild in their youth and what becomes of them.
Wow, that's fascinating terrain. Thank you very much for joining us today. That was Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. You've been listening to The Bibliopod for the weekend of August 21st. Find new episodes at macleans.ca and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and BeyondPod. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. Theme music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music is by Salman Gatke from his album Under the Red, White, and Blue. Thanks to Anne Lavery and Scott Metcalf. Thanks for listening.